Hello and welcome to Radio Inqilab, a podcast focused on change makers who are working to educate, resolve, and change the complex systems within which we live. Radio Inqilab aims to bring voices to the forefront who have traditional as well as modern solutions for our planet, can share knowledge on how we take decisive action and live in harmony with each other and Mother Earth. In this time of chaos, disinformation, and negativity, Radio Inqilab seeks to focus on ideas that work and the positive impact they can have. My name is Rupande Mehta, and I come to you from Lenape Land in New Jersey.
Today, our guest is Athar Zia. Athar Zia is an anthropologist and a poet. She's an assistant professor at the Anthropology Department and Gender Studies program at University of Northern Colorado. She has been a journalist with BBC World Service and has done a brief stint as a civil servant with the Kashmir government. Athar is a published author and columnist. Her essays and creative work, including fiction and poetry, have appeared in a variety of magazines. She has published her first collection of poems titled The Frame. In 2013, Athar won the second prize for ethnographic poetry in Kashmir from the Society for Humanistic Anthropology. She's the founder editor of Kashmir Lit, a journal based on writings in Kashmir at www.kashmirlit.org. Athar is currently working on a book based on the enforced disappearances that have occurred at the hands-on Indian troops in Kashmir. Athar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Rupande. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about your childhood. Where did you grow up, and what were the key moments when your activism for Kashmir evolved?
So I was born in Kashmir. I was brought up in Kashmir. I did my schooling in Kashmir till high school and even after, and just left towards the after I did one of my masters in Kashmir, came for another here into the United States, and also joined as a journalist. So thinking about the key moments in my life which raised my political consciousness, so to speak, I have extensively talked about it in an edited book. This seems like a shameless plug, but it's also very important to mention that book because I do know that you wanted to ask about resources. So there's a book that I've co-edited. It's called A Desolation Called Peace, and it was published with HarperCollins. And why did I want to do that kind of work? Like, it's an edited volume that's based on memoiristic pieces by Kashmiris, asking them this very question about their political consciousness, about their political subjectivity, because I know there is this fallacy around Kashmir that everything started in 1989, and I want to draw the listeners' attention to the fact that Kashmiris have been politically conscious in the manner that they've been seen in the last 30 years, since 1947, and for lack of a better milestone, from 1931, when so the quote-unquote the revolution inside Kashmir started, and that is way before creation of India and Pakistan happens. Now, where did my personal consciousness, political consciousness, or this political subjectivity that realized that there is something amiss in us, when did that begin? I want to say that it began in my childhood, but it was so amorphous, it was so subterranean that I didn't even know what was happening. And that's what these people in the memoiristic pieces in that edited volume, they talk about. Some of them are very, very clear, like when their political subjectivity emerged and, floated to the surface. I can see those key moments in myself as well, but they emerge more as questions, as who are we? What is happening? Like these late night dinner conversations that happened in each household, and I'm sure they happened in all households. Like, what's Mahazrai Shumari, meaning the right to self-determination? What is plebiscite? And why are these dinner time conversations so fraught? And why are people talking about them as if they are not allowed in public space? So, as a child, you assimilate all of this. And And then these histories that are kind of like swarming and swirling around you. Like, what did the Dogra monarchy mean? And why was my grandfather or why was my grand uncle involved in some kind of a revolution that I don't see remnants of? And what is a revolution? You know, these questions were not only in my mind. Now, when I meet people in my generation, they have been part and parcel of our Kashmiriness right from the very beginning. And whereas they did not make me politically subjective in that moment, it was a contribution to my subjectivity, these conversations that were happening. And then the key moment is the late 80s, when I was, you know, a school, I was, you know, a schoolgoer, and I realized that we have like active armed struggle going on. And what is happening? We were told for the longest possible time, Kashmir was really seen as this horizon of tourism and this cosmetic piece for the longest possible time, where people go to have a holiday or people go for a honeymoon. And then there is also Bollywood movies being shot. And we also know that there is Azad Kashmir, which is being administered by Pakistan. So all of these, while there is no one key moment, they're all contributing towards the key moment, which is the late 1980s, when people like me, who also had not studied Kashmiri, had not studied Kashmiri history because that was not part and parcel of our school. And I know that's quote unquote like a very post-colonial aftermath in most of the South Asian countries where we don't know much about our own history, but know all the world history and all of that. I know there is a remnant to that, but there is also a deliberate curriculum where Kashmiri history, Kashmiri language was not taught in the same manner. It was almost as if like you had to distance yourself from this identity to become someone, which was to gain hold on English, to gain hold on world history. So all of these, I think, culminated in the moment when 1989 happens, or even before, like 1988, 1987, you begin to question, like, who are we? Weren't we supposed to be like having the Dal Lake and you know, the mountains, and we have these resorts, and why is there so much tension, and what is this conflagration about? And then also to see the ironies and the contrast, while Kashmiris call it the Tehrik, which means revolution, why is India calling it militancy, and why is India to down the line be able to call it terrorism, you know, unabashedly? So I think those were they were key to the contrariness that I was feeling as a Kashmiri, with my Kashmiri subjectivity, and then wanting to become a writer, wanting to become a journalist. And suddenly I realized we don't have a story. Like, our story is not what has been told to us. And some people would be talking about the history in 1947 and 1931. There were contradictory histories. Different households had different stories about what was happening to them. And then I realized there was a collaborator section, the Indian collaborator section in Kashmir, which had sided with India, which had seized the narrative in 1947. And then there were households who had suffered severe repression, whose members had been exiled to either Pakistan-administered Kashmir, which is also known as the Azad Kashmir, and also England. England has the highest Muslim Kashmiri diaspora, and Birmingham and all of those places. So these kind of like, these come in waves, one after the other, and one after the other. So I think that happened to my generation, because our generation was the one that was kind of like a bridge between the ones who, maybe not as a bridge, but which came at close at the hands of the ones who picked up arms, and the ones who had kind of like hunkered down and tried to, you know, just create some reforms so that they get some level of financial stability and social stability. So yeah, I think those are not the key moments, but they're the key waves.
It's interesting when you were talking about Kashmir in the beginning and how the dinner time conversations you were mentioning those. I'm thinking about Kashmir as you mentioned it later, the Dal Lake, the honeymoon spot, Bollywood. So it's almost like people outside of Kashmir
have a completely different understanding of what is going on in Kashmir. Most people perhaps are not even aware of the fraught nature that is being, suffered by the people who live in Kashmir. You also mentioned many years. You said 1931. You talked about 1947, which is of course the independence of India from the British, and also the partition of India into India and Pakistan. And then you also mentioned in the late 1980s. Tell me a little bit about the key moments in Kashmir's history.
Well, Kashmir's history, we have to. So I'm going to answer this in a more universal way so that the audience, which is global, which is international, kind of connects the dots of what has happened in South Asia in what we see as post-colonialism. And I think that's very important even to understand what's happening in Palestine in this current moment of genocide. And what its history is, it really that we can connect the dots. So the key moments in Kashmir, let's kind of think about them. When you ask a Kashmiri, like, what are the key moments in your history that have brought you to the point where you say that this is an Indian occupation, and also cannot say this because then there are these laws that are going to be forced on you, meted on you, which has created so many human rights abuse, so much human rights abuse, and also prisonerhood, political prisonerhood inside Kashmir. So Kashmiris like to kind of like, there's a long arc. One is when the Mughals enter Kashmir in 1556 or 1586, I'm not clear on the date, but it's the 15th, 16th century when the Mughals
Yeah,
first.
it's close enough.
When the Mughal rule enters Kashmir. So we kind of see that as first occupation in a series of other occupations, but the first one that kind of leads to the dispossession of Kashmiris, which led to 1947. Then we kind of begin with thinking about the Sikh rule, the Afghani rule, and then also thinking about the Dogra rule, which were basically the warlords that had helped the British Empire oust the Sikh Empire. And then the warlords established a monarchy called the Dogra regime, which lasted almost more than 100 years till 1947, when the ruling monarch, who was really seen as a despot, he fled and said that whatever Lord Mountbatten, who was representing the British rule, had said that there's going to be a plebiscite in Kashmir, and there was also a war ongoing between India and Pakistan over Kashmir at that point in 1947. And he kind of signed what is known as the Treaty of Accession, which is again disputed whether he signed or what happened to that. So I don't want to really talk a lot about the historical element, because what has happened in the past 70 years is we are made to answer that history, justify that history. And I think that's not the correct way to go. How is it that a fleeing monarch, who is doing this at the behest of a colonial empire, is dividing a people just because he thinks he can? And then we have to go on for the next 70 years justifying all of that and going by a 19th century solution to a 21st century problem, which we are facing in this particular moment. So I think these are important questions that we need to ask as critical Kashmir studies scholars, activists, and people inside the region. So Kashmiris like to go back to these occupations at different times because they're kind of trying to tell you that this is the long arc of our dispossession. During all of those rules, Kashmiris were indentured slaves. They were peasants. They were tillers. They did not have access to their own lands. They were taxed very heavily. There were plagues. They were mostly living in a very wretched state. And on the other hand, there was a ruling class, a ruling elite, which was comprised of Kashmiri pandits and some Muslim families and clergy and some Muslim elite. And they together were kind of like propping up each of the occupation, and it was moving from the Mughals to the Afghans to the Sikhs to the to British and to the Dogras, and then to the Dogras and British together, because the British towards the end realized, oh, they should not have sold Kashmir to the warlords, because they were kind of like, playing the long game with Russia at that time, and they were like, we probably need to enter back. And we see things happening towards 1947, which a lot of people think that they were trying to ease Kashmiris, which I think is not easing Kashmiris, but they were actually threatening the Dogras that we are going to come back in if you do so and so things that you're doing. So those are the key moments. And there is also some socialist or social or labor movements that took place inside Kashmir. I forget the date exactly, but somewhere in 1856, let's say, where when the shawl workers got together, that they kind of like wanted to. They were working against the shawl tax. The Kashmiri shawl was actually reaching Europe, and even Napoleon's wife was wearing shawls, and Victorian Empire and the people around it, they were doing trades in shawls and using these Kashmiri shawls. But the Kashmiri artisans were taxed so heavily that some of them, they cut their fingertips off because they didn't want to do the shawls. It wasn't giving them anything, and some of them had to move. They left Kashmir because of the taxation. So when you see all of that, how many Kashmiris have left? And when we say, and then the other one happens in 1931 when Kashmiris rose against the Dogra Mughals, sorry, the Dogra rulers, and they wanted to establish their own sovereignty, basically, and oust him, or have a more constitutional monarchy where there is some sort of people's government as well. And that's the moment when you see Quit Kashmir happening. In India at that time, you had the Quit India movement. In Kashmir, you had the Quit Kashmir movement. And from 1931 onwards, you also see the stirrings of a communal distress inside Kashmir between Muslim Kashmiris and pundits who were the ruling elites, and 2 to 4% of the population, and the rest were Muslims and also Christians and some Sikh denomination. So why do you see that? Because 1931, 1932 was also the time of Glanzi Commission. When the British came in, they wanted to look at the discrimination, not because of they were like well-wishers of Muslims, but because the Muslims took their grievances to the British and wherever they could, also talking to some of their Indian allies at that moment. They wanted to tell them that Kashmiri Muslims were discriminated against. They did not have as many rights. They did not have right to land. They did not have the same rights to property. And also there was, even the prostitutes, the prostitution was legal, and the prostitutes were taxed. It was like such a depraved social setup that was created against the Muslims. So 1931, you see that revolution kind of starting, but that revolution starts in the social discrimination, but it ends up very political against the ruler. And that's another key moment when the Dogra ruler, he comes in with his army and he executes 22 Kashmiris. And that's kind of like 1931 is the 13th July 1931 is seen as the Martyrs' Day in Kashmir. And now what BJP recently has done is it has really created a new aspect out of that history, which Kashmiris, pundits and Muslims have a problem with, especially the ruler, the Dogra ruler. Now they have made the Dogra ruler's birthday is a holiday, and they're also kind of like casting them as saviors. And as not as despots, but as democratic sovereigns of some kind. So that's kind of like that key moment in 1931. And then 1947 is another key moment when the partition of India happens, which is known as partition, but I kind of like say creation of India and Pakistan, because I feel the word partition also gives this monumental privilege to the current dispensation in India, and also many others, maybe from the previous ruling dispensations, of creating this idea of a continued unbroken country from times immemorial, which I think BJP is using really badly and against people and against other communities, and using it to fuel more Hindu supremacy. So partition doesn't really help us. I think what helps us is the creation of these two countries, and on the basis of Westphalian system, a Eurocentric system. While the rest of the world calls this post-colonialism, but when you look at it through the from the aspect of Kashmir, which is an unsolved dispute, or you look at it from the angle of Palestine, you're leaving, and then the British mandate is ending, and then you decide to kind of like bring other people and bring settler colonialism through a different dimension and through a different set of people, but who are Europeans. And then through a different ideology, but you're doing the same thing. So these both things were seeded in what was known as the era of post-colonialism. And that's how it kind of shaped up in political theory and literature, but which from both angles looks like the start of a new form of neo-colonialism or settler colonialism. So that's 1947 in a Kashmiri person's life. That is the time when United Nations, which we see as a post-colonial institution, but which for all practical purposes is a neo-colonial institution. And they kind of like step in, stop the fighting between India and Pakistan, create a line of control and say, now this place is divided into two. We're going to do a plebiscite. And then on the other hand, you have the Maharaja fleeing because West Kashmir was fighting against him and they had one part to one third of the land, which is now called as Azad Kashmir. So while India on one hand tries to say that, oh, you know, that's our territory, you know, all of that can be debated, and we can also understand it from the lens of Kashmiris winning that side, calling it Azad Kashmir, because that's what they named it. But then when UN steps in, it says, okay, you know, we are going to create this new truce, so to speak. So this one third is under Pakistan administration, two thirds is under Indian administration, and we'll have a plebiscite. But that plebiscite is also it's a hogwash. You can either join India or you can join Pakistan. There's no third option. And well, whereas there is so that's why I feel like all of these questions thus far have been answered through the idiom of post-colonialism or post-colonial order. But I think that it really needs to be understood through and after what we see happening in Palestine in this moment with the genocide, and how we see that the settler occupation is not stopping at anything. And then you look at India and you look how the policies of India are condoned, whereas they are, you cannot do all the things that you're doing in a disputed territory. You cannot create so much infrastructural change. You cannot take away people's autonomy that you yourself have promised them in your constitution, the way you did in 2019, unilaterally, militarily. And then, you know, the world is going to condone you. So that kind of makes us think from that vantage of the people who are occupied that something else is going on. There is no post-colonialism. The biggest definition of decolonization that United Nations has is creation of countries on the prototype of a Westphalian democracy. That's not decolonization. That is the definition of what theorists and politicians like Kwame Nkrumah have said long back in the 1960s, that this is the very ideal of neocolonialism. And I think all of these oppressions are linked. And yes, going back to, so these are kind of like the milestones. I know that was a long answer.
No, but it was necessary to get the context, and that is the reason I asked, because, and specifically because when we've been talking a lot about Palestine lately, because of everything that's going on, and rightly so, but a lot of people are under the impression that Palestine's quote unquote history began on October 7th, and that's not what the reality is. The reality goes back hundreds of years. So my intention in asking you the question is that there was a lot of oppression that has been going on in Kashmir for many, many years as well. This is not something that is recent. This is not something that has began today. But talking about, you know, the long history, you talked about the Mughals, the Sikh Afghanis, the Dogras, they were all, you know, each one had their own sort of oppressive level, the Dogras being sort of perhaps the most outstanding ones in terms of the oppression. But I don't think anybody else was, you know, any softer, so to speak. Considering that, and then talking about it today, what is going on in Kashmir today? Why is it so fraught? I mean, I think some of the points that you've made so far in terms of, your childhood as well, just growing up and kind of asking these questions, point to that direction, that there is, a lot of violence going on and there's a lot of sort of tension in the region. But what is the current situation? And then I want to actually also ask you this. I want to take this opportunity because India is currently voting. For Modi's next term, and it most probably looks like he's going to win with fraud and just total sort of misrepresentation. What does that mean for Kashmir as well going forward?
So again, these questions in terms of Kashmir have to be answered historically. And again, as we are watching what's happening in Palestine with the genocide, with the world literally silent, doing, it's a theater of neocolonialism that's happening in this moment, even with the ICJ and UN and all of that. Except for common people putting their bodies online. I feel the rest is neocolonial theater. It's very important to kind of begin at the beginning, in whichever the beginning we can. I know that beginnings can be biased, but I think in this case, we have clear historical beginnings. So when we think about democracy, we have to ask the question that did Kashmir ever have a democracy? Just like asking the question that indigenous people here in America, did they ever have democracy? Do Palestinians live under a democracy, even if the Israeli settler state calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East? So we have to question that. I know that we as South Asians and we as non-Western people, we are so apologetic for democracy. We are made to kind of like be those good citizens and ask for democracy and say, we've been democratic. And that is the very definition of how neocolonialism has shaped us. And it's almost like we are questioning our past in a way as if we did not have any kind of civility, as if we did not have any merit in the governances that our people had. So I think part of our problem lies in that as well. And then once India is created, and I'm talking about India, I'm not talking about Pakistan, because I have not lived under Pakistan's administration. I have lived under India's occupation and India's administration. And I call it Indian administered Kashmir for a better part of my writing, because that kind of goes back to the historicity of what this land is. It's disputed, it's on the UN agenda. And even if I don't believe in the whole sort of the behemoth of United Nations in that sense, but it does. You can deploy it to say certain truths in the modern day and age. So going back to thinking about elections, what elections can be fought and can be instituted in a disputed territory? The first elections in 1951. There is a bit British Pathe, I think that's how it's pronounced or not, I don't know. There's a short documentary about 1951 elections. It says towards the end, it says, it's kind of like questioning, like, how can you have elections in a disputed territory? And then towards the end, it says, okay, the order of this era, something like that, I might be paraphrasing. It says, okay, the order of the era is annex a country and do elections. So it's actually kind of like, giving us a cue towards what India did. So in 1951, when India constitutes the elections and does this electoral business, Pakistan has an objection, United Nations has an objection, and they say that these cannot be done because the case is sub judice. And India comes back and it says, no, we can do these elections for the sake of governance, but once these are done, plebiscite is still on the table. But this is just for the people's governance, because we have to give them governance, and that's what they use. So that's how they kind of like start the electoral process. And here's the thing: the problem is that the world is not the neocolonial order, the ones who are overseeing whatever UN is doing, maybe the Security Council, maybe the powers that have the veto powers. They don't care about democracy. They care about politics of democracy. And that's what India has done from the very first day. There is a weaponization of democratic processes, and electoral business that they do is pivotal in that. They show the world that we are doing this electoral thing, the voting process. So that kind of somehow makes it seem to the world that Kashmiris are endorsing Indian rule, which is a fallacy. Kashmiris see voting as part of governance. They do not see it as part of their independence or freedom movement. They see they have two politics. One is the politics of governance, and the other is politics of freedom. So there is two politics happening even today when Kashmiris are so persecuted and they have so many laws impinging on them that they cannot speak. And that's the reality after 2019. So the electoral process right from the get-go, you had predetermined candidates. And I earlier said there was a collaborator class. They were basically the client politicians of India. And sadly, those people had been the greatest visionaries in 1931, till they kind of were slowly co-opted. And they were also kind of like, they kind of sided with India because of the linkages that they had with the Nehru family, with the first prime minister of India, who was also a Kashmiri Pandit by legacy. So you see that. And then in 1951, he fights the election. And in 1953, he's gone. He's in jail. And then you have another person who for the next decade erodes the Kashmiri, helps erode the Kashmiri autonomy agreement, which was signed in which began as a discussion in 1947 and was already the seeds of which were already sown by the fleeing Maharaja and Mountbatten. But 1949, it becomes into Article 370, promising the plebiscite, promising semi-autonomy, promising Kashmir its own prime minister and its own president. So once you throw the earlier collaborator away, then you have the next one coming for a decade, and he abolishes the prime minister and president nomenclature. Now they become chief minister and governor, like rest of the Indian states. And then they also slowly and steadily had begun to erode the autonomy agreement, which had begun right the next day, because Jawaharlal Nehru had said that it's going to take time, but it's going to be folded at one point, the Article 370. But the Kashmiri vantage was that Article 370, the autonomy agreement had been done by this Constituent Assembly, which had been disbanded right after. So they thought that the autonomy agreement from the Kashmiri side was ironclad and it would never be taken away. So then the next 10 years after, when I said the first client politician in 1953, he was, I think it was 1953, he was put in jail. And for the next 22 years, he was in political wilderness and also in exile and jail. Then you have the next set of people come in who kind of bring the Congress ideology into Kashmir. And that kind of lasts till 1975, when the earlier Sheikh Abdullah comes back. So now what's happening is, it's a politics of democracy being played with these pawns who are all Kashmiri collaborators, client politicians, promising one group a number of seats. So it's predetermined, it's rigged. And I think Indian researchers have written a lot about that period of how that was managed. So Kashmir was never, there was no negotiation ever. It was always handled. That's how Indian interlocutors have always talked about Kashmir, as handling Kashmir. So that was Kashmiri lot till, let's say, 1984. And in 1984, what happens is that you have the pro, quote unquote, the pro freedom, or the resistance, people who had resistance ideology. They decided that they had been criminalized right from the get-go. So why not fight an election? And then when they have the hold on assembly, they are going to talk about plebiscite and right to self-determination. But the election was rigged again. And that, in the Indian parlance, a lot of analysts have said India did not give democracy a chance inside Kashmir. But what I say is that there was never a democracy to begin with. You cannot have electoral democracy the way India wanted to institute it, to endorse its rule inside a disputed territory. It was politics of democracy right from the get-go. So it was bound to fail. And that's what many militants who were interviewed in that period said. And they said that, this is just another chapter in Kashmir's Azadi. If they had not rigged the elections, and Sayyid Salahuddin, who is the head of the Mujahideen conglomerate and who is in Azad Kashmir now, he was a teacher and he stood up for elections. And there were other people, Yasin Malik, one of the co-founders of JKLF movement, the Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front. He was one of the polling agents and he was beaten and he was thrown in jail. So, but they all are of the opinion that it's not the failure of democracy. That was one of the ways that we could have captured the assembly and talked about Kashmir's freedom. But it was the politics of democracy which was bound to fail from day one. And then what do we see after 1984 elections? And what do we see in 1996? What do we see in 2014? Ask any Kashmiri. There's a clip going on in this moment right now. It's circulating. There's a woman, maybe she's a grandmother's age, and then there is a guy maybe in his late 40s, early 40s. All of them say, except for this one old man who lives in the remote part of Kashmir and North Kashmir, and that place is quite notorious for the fact that the military usually goes into the houses and brings everyone out for voting. Except for him, no one says that they have ever voted. And from my ethnographic work and my field work, there is this, I've written about this a little bit, where a person told me that not voting is my right, that I don't want to vote. And that's what most of these people in these clips that are circulating right now with respect to the election that's happening. I know this is a long answer, but I'll try to make this quick. Now, in 2014 was the last election that was held inside Kashmir. And then a coalition government with Bharatiya Janata Party came into being, which was dismissed in 2018. In 2029, autonomy was taken away without unilaterally, militarily, by an executive decree, which many constitutional lawyers and experts have called deceitful, have called illegal, given different ways, given different legal injunctions. And now, for 9 long years, there has been no elections, and for the last 5 years, there has been no elected local government inside Kashmir. And then the Indian government said that we're going to do the panchayat elections, which they did, and their term ended in January, and now there's no one again. So there is this deep mismanagement and this perception that has been developed, and that's because Kashmir literally is under an authoritarian occupation, military occupation for the longest possible time. But then there's also been a front of local administration. And then from 1989 onwards, you had the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, when in 1996 you had the local administration come back again, but you had two core commanders as your advisors. So that's kind of like a government of the army and fronted by sort of like these administrators who were quote unquote elected. They were not really elected. No one in Kashmir, there's like a 2%, you can see the numbers. So if you look at the long arc of democracy, it's basically been a management of trying to show this politics that has been played with people, this theater of democracy, where votes have been weaponized, this whole optic of people going out to vote as if that's the practice of democracy. That's been kind of shown to the world, where in truth, it's not the democracy that many people think democracy is. I don't think that exists anywhere, but in Kashmir more so.
I was just thinking that when you were talking about it. And I do want to come back to this because I think your thoughts on this would be important about how really there's no democracy anywhere. Because we're seeing what we're living apparently in a democracy in the United States, but to what extent are we really democratic considering everything we've been witnessing over the past 6 months, and in many cases beyond. So I do want to get your thoughts on that. But before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about your writing. You're a pretty prolific writer. You also talked about your journalism experience, and you have written more than one book. And in your book, Resisting Disappearance, Military Occupation and Women's Activism in Kashmir, you talk about the thousands of men who have disappeared by the Indian government and the activist women, part of the Association of Parents for Disappeared Persons.
Talk a little bit about that. Where are these men disappearing? What are the women doing? What's going on?
So we can look at it through the prism of technology of terror and control that has been operational on Kashmiri people from 1989, because the armed movement starts in a new phase in 1989, and it's a very popular movement where people are actually taking part. They're not taking part in the armed aspect of it, but the emotional, the affective, and the support that these armed movement and fighters received from Kashmiri people. So that was also the movement when that was also the time period when the pundits left Kashmir to Jammu and other parts of India, and many other Kashmiri Muslims who were seen to side with India. And many Kashmiri pundits were also pro, many of them were pro-independence, but a majority of them were pro-India. And that kind of like brought them into the purview of this persecutorial policies of the militants, and which led to many killings of pundits who might have been or not have been part of the collaborator setup that India had created inside Kashmir with Kashmiri Muslims as well. So many people, pundits and Kashmiris left at that time, who were actually actively seen as many. And I think the first person who was killed, assassinated by the fighters, was a BJP representative. So that's kind of very telling. So that's kind of the time, the 1989 part of the movement, in that I forgot the question, sorry.
It's
Oh, you were
okay.
asking me about the it disappeared.
The
So
disappearance.
when that happens, 1991, when Armed Forces Special Powers Act comes into force, then you also have the Disturbed Areas Act. So what essentially happens, it's a Armed Forces Powers Act is part of this colonial constitutionalism that India still carries from its British laws. So what you can do is you can make it's basically that the local machinery has failed, or quote unquote democracy has failed. Now we are essentially giving this particular region to military, and the military becomes preeminent. And that's Kashmir's 1991. And now you also know from that AFSPA was also in Assam and Tripura, and it had been there for a long period of time because of the issues that they had had with the Indian Federation. So what essentially happens is that there is no local administration, there are no local representatives, and from 1987, 88 onwards till 1996, you don't have this is this that's a period when it's the militancy is on the rise, the armed struggle is on the rise, there are demonstrations on the streets, pundits have left the region, Kashmiri Muslims who side with India are also leaving the region. And then the other exodus is also of Kashmiri Muslims who are seen to side with either Pakistan or independence movement. They're also being persecuted by the army. They're all leaving the region, going off to Azad Kashmir and other parts of Pakistan through the line of control. Then you also have lots of army being stationed, which already was there, but now you have more than 700,000 troops at one point in time. So Kashmir is one of the most densely populated, one of the highest militarized region in the world. And the statistics kind of vary, and depending on how many statistics government of India wants to release, and they kind of change. But I think this is a long-standing statistic. In many books, you will find that at one point in time, the army was 700,000. And it has complete power to kill, disappear, maim, arrest, interrogate, detain with least accountability, no accountability at all, and with complete impunity. And that's the time when you see Kashmiris being forcibly disappeared, killed, there are human rights abuses are rampant, and disappearance, the enforced disappearance, was kind of like sort of like this premier technology of persecution. And then a lot of people were killed, both combatants and non-combatants. That happens in disappearances as well. Human Rights Watch in 1994 does a report saying that rape is being used as a weapon of war. There were widows, there were orphans. And then So the technology of torture in the 90s was, of course, killings and extrajudicial killings and detainments and harassment, you know, checkpoints, which a lot of journalists, when they came into Kashmir, they're like, this is like West Bank. This is like Palestine. So there was that sensorial element to the occupation. And there was also sharing of technology from the Israeli forces to the Indian forces as well. So there was that transference happening at that time. So disappearances happened, more than 8,000 disappearances. And this is, again, a long-standing statistic. These are documented disappearances by the human rights watchdogs all across the world, from Human Rights Watch to Amnesty International to physicians, you know, MSF, and I think some of the judicial, I forget the acronyms, but, you know, judicial groups as well. And then in the 2000s, you had the grassroots movement, which was kind of known as the Intifada in Kashmir. Then the technology of torture changes, and they began using pellet shotguns when you had those mass blindings happening from 2008 onwards till 2016, and then some after as well. Then 29 changes it altogether because India decides to take away the autonomy and change all the laws. And now I think if a Kashmiri breathes loudly, that is going to come under some act and they are going to be jailed or dispossessed in some way or the other. That's the current situation. So the disappearances happened in the 90s. And then there were so many disappearances, and I was in Kashmir. I was still young and watching things happening, and we'd watch people either extrajudicially be killed, be maimed. There were combatants who were being killed. There were non-combatants who were being killed and disappeared. So that kind of stayed with me as I thought it was a window for the world to understand that if you're calling India a democracy and you are you're really condoning what India is doing and, you know, patting them on the back for having yoga, for having ahimsa, and kind of that's your ideology. And also, you know, thinking of India as this laid back place where you go to find your spiritual side and all of that, how is it possible that this democracy can disappear people who are leaving homes in the morning, never returning in the evening? And that happened to friends of mine, and who were very young, and never return to their families. Then see women go crazy, and then see women. Then as you're coming from school, you see a group of women like walking from one place to another, looking for their sons. That does stay in your psyche. And that is something that is also a window and leads you to question. Earlier, you were asking about the key moments. While that was not the originary moment, but that was one of the moments when I realized, like, what kind of system are we living in that people are getting disappeared, being disappeared? It's a verb, you know, they were being disappeared. And how is it that it's a democracy? Like, who is responsible for all of this? And I also know that people did see their struggle as a valid, just struggle. That's when they kind of connected their struggle to Palestinian struggle, because these are the two earliest disputes on the agenda of United Nations. And we have a United Nations headquarters inside Kashmir. There are 44 installations all across the region, which does show the disputed nature. So whatever people were doing, whether it was an armed struggle or it was a political struggle, they were identifying with a valid, legit movement. And still people get disappeared like that. And, you know, you have curfews happening. You have all kinds of persecutions happening. And there is breakdown in public orders, quote unquote. There is breakdown in administrative machinery. But that was the idea. The idea was to break down the structure that people did not want imposed on them. So in that, you had combatants and non-combatants being disappeared. There is a study out there which shows that the people are from 8 years old to 45 years old. Most of them are 25 years old, and many of them are bearded. And that's a certain stereotype that is being disappeared. That is a certain demonized Muslim subjectivity and identity being kind of chosen to disappear. So these were questions that kind of, like, I thought that if you present this to a world, because I was naive then, I thought that the world belonged, and I hadn't learned about too much about American democracy, and that we thought America was home of the free, land of brave, completely negating the history of indigenous people here. And now I realize that I am waking up in someone else's nightmare. And now I'm old as well. And I don't know what to do with the kind of positionality I have now. But I think it's also in some ways we are positioned right. We are at the heart of the empire and we can ask these questions. So it was naive of me in that moment to think, like, what if I ask this question in my research? Like, how is India a democracy when this is happening? And I thought it was a very good way of understanding Kashmir's history and using this window of enforced disappearances to help the world understand that there has never been democracy inside Kashmir. It's always been a politics. It's always been a tool that has been wielded to kind of show that Kashmiris are endorsing Indian rule, which they were not. They were clearly seeing it as a policy of politics of governance, where they were kind of like, you know, just letting India do what it was doing because it had the imposition. So yeah, that's how those disappearances occurred. And then in 1994, the mothers, one of the mothers, she decided along with a human rights lawyer to formalize and have a group. And it became a preeminent human rights group. It won an award, won several awards, global awards. But then after 2019, the houses of these people, the founders and the activists, have been raided, they have been persecuted. And now in this moment, as we speak, there are two different Association of Parents of Disappeared Persons. One of them is headed by the mother, Parveena Ahangar, and another one is headed by Parvez Imroz, who is the human rights lawyer. They're running two organizations, and they have been co-nominated for many awards and won the RAFTO Award, Human Rights Award in 2017. But today, the spokesperson of one of the APDPs is under incarceration, Khurram Parvez. He has been incarcerated since November 21. And there are several cases against him, and all of them are kind of focused on repressing his work as a human rights defender who is trying to defend and document and witness the human rights abuses that Indian Army, the Indian forces, and also the local police, and also the militia have committed inside the region. And the disappearance is one of the biggest problems that Kashmiris faced. And it's also an open wound. You don't know where the people are, whether they're killed, whether they are alive somewhere. And the government of India at different moments and the local administration, they would not call them forcibly disappeared. They would call them missing. Many times alluding that there are only 60 people who have been, and they're all in Azad Kashmir. So there's also that politics of naming. But these human rights defenders, they're really steadfast with the numbers that they have, with the documentation, archivization that they have done. But in this moment, key human rights defenders, amidst which Khurram Parvez's name is most visible because he's worked with a lot of human rights organizations across the globe, and he's quite well known. He is incarcerated at the moment, and we don't know what kind of he's being framed in one case after the other. And most of the time, these cases don't hold water.
No, they're bogus. They're bogus. Thank you for providing the context there. So my next question for you, I'm not going to ask you this question because we've already touched a lot about it, but I want to read it anyway, because there was something that really touched me in this writing of yours. So when I was researching for this interview, I came across one of your writings around when Article 370 was revoked. That is the special provision that was afforded to Kashmir that has now been revoked. This entire essay, Listening Through the Silence in Adi magazine, was extremely heartbreaking to read, and it invoked many emotions. One of the most striking lines in this essay for me was on August 13, 2019, the ninth day of the siege, I wrote in my journal, Eid passed peacefully through checkpoints, razor wires, and children that know how to stay still. There was so much in that line for me. And when I read that, my first thought was Palestine. Now, you've touched a lot already on the parallels between Palestine and Kashmir. So I'm not going to ask you to explain that. Instead, I'd like your thoughts, because you mentioned connect the dots many times, and we've talked about how this is not really a post-colonial world. It's more of a neo-colonization still going on. And we are seeing the rise of repression, suppression of freedom of speech, even here in this country, right? We've seen what's going on in with students of Columbia University and all these other, you know, everybody who has dared to stand up for Palestine right now is basically an anti-Semite. Although that means nothing to the people of Israel because they're all from Europe. What are your thoughts on this connect the dots, right? You talked about Indian police being trained by the Israeli police. There is a lot of sort of connections that people ought to make to understand this big picture. What are your thoughts about that?
I really think, in my work as a scholar, I was trained as a post-colonial scholar, right? I was told to use the lens of post-colonialism, that I have a post-colonial identity and all of that. So when I looked at the post-colonial literature, and I hugely respect Edward Said's work because he's kind of seen as the semi-daddy of post-colonialism. But I'm not talking about his post-colonialism or his Orientalist theory, which holds good, which has no, there's no, there's nothing, there's no gaps there. But what I'm talking about, what happened to post-colonialism when the Indian scholars take it further, and also when we kind of like look at it through the subaltern studies and all of that. My question to those scholars is, where is Kashmir in that post-colonial theory? When I look at it from the vantage of Kashmir, or I look at it from the vantage of what's happened in Palestine in the past 75 years, or what's happened to Indigenous people here in Canada and US. My question is, like, where are they? And why aren't they visible? So my contention is that post-colonialism has hidden more than it has exposed when it comes to these bleeding wounds of places. And that's where this theory becomes inadequate, not because it doesn't have the space and the heart to think about these issues, but because it has been made to focus on a certain type of subjectivity and identity and a certain type of concern and what should I say, like this engagement with who we are in this democratic setup. When essentially you look at India in this moment, and again, I say India, because that's the one that's mostly touted as the democracy in South Asia, as the big brother in South Asia, and which has these conflagrations all across what's known as borders. Look what's happening in what's known as the Northeast. But again, that the question is like Northeast or what? But the states which are in the Northeast of Delhi. Look what's happening, what was happening in the South or still is. Some sort of a this deep cultural disengagement, even if it's not political in that sense. And then look what's happening in the heartland. Look what's happening to the indigenous peoples. And this is all about resources. This is all about extractivism. This is all about centralizing power and taking power from people. And I think what India is, and as I kind of write, Kwame Nkrumah is on my is at the forefront of my brain today because I was teaching about him. He talks about the African independence and he writes this entire book in the 60s, right when he's doing all of that. He's saying that we are finding this new continent and we're doing all of this. But he is making it very clear, unlike Jawaharlal Nehru. And he's saying that we are propagating a neo-colonial entity because we are trained by the colonials and we have the Westphalian structures in place. So we're going to be nothing but neo-colonials and neo-colonial structures. And I think for me, post-colonialism doesn't work. It did work for some time till I was invisibilizing Indigenous people here and I wasn't connecting to their histories because I wasn't taught that in my anthropological canon in the same way. And when I looked at the history of scientific racism, and you kind of like go deeper and deeper, and anthropology as the handmaiden of colonialism, and you go a little deeper and more deeper and deeper, and you're like, oh my God, there's turtles down all the way. And that's what happens in India. And when India today is taking hold of a decolonial narrative through what Modi is saying, I see that as a response to neocolonialism. And in that moment, while I'm not redeeming the government, I also see the victim heart there that is insecure. But it's not only speaking to Mughals, it's also speaking to the higher power that it knows it's in it's kind of like it's in the sort of like the grip of the neocolonial power. And if it doesn't become like one, then it has no chance. It doesn't stand a chance. And I think that's the story of most of the countries that have been created. And as I said, and I said the we have to connect the dots. When we think about Palestine, we have to think about we have to think about European settler colonialism using the Jewish history and suffering and creation of Zionism way before the Holocaust years. And of course, there was the persecution, but then you had the Arab Jews, you had people who were living in the Levant and other places. So you had a different history. So you kind of like see the creation of whiteness. Vis-a-vis, I mean, that's a longer history, but then also the sort of seeding that bringing Zionism into Middle East. And I forget the name of the English politician who said that Palestine is going to be the Clapham Junction. We can go anywhere. And we see that happening in this moment. And when you look at Kashmir, that's technically the Clapham Junction of South Asia. You can go anywhere. You want to go China? Go China. You want to go Pakistan? Go Pakistan. You want to travel up to Iran? Travel up to Iran. And that is what Kashmir has been for the longest possible time. It has been a very strategic piece of land where you just have to travel a few mountains and you're everywhere. You can go to the Indian subcontinent. You can go, if you want to go anywhere in a South Asian subcontinent, Kashmir is really a geostrategic place, and it's no wonder it's suffering this much. And today, if you were to present Kashmir's situation to the world that believes in development, that believes in tourism, that believes in neoliberal extractivism, that believes in ecocide, because that's what we're seeing, to them, Kashmir is not a problem in the moment. That's why we see the G5s going and doing their meetings there. And that's how we see these big conglomerates from United Arab Emirates. People might be like, oh, you know, that those are Muslims, maybe they'll understand. They don't. They understand neoliberalism and neocolonialism very well. And they are players in that. And they are very easily overlooking Kashmiri suffering for the last 72 years. And siding with India, trading with India, while India was taking away Kashmir's autonomy in 2019, I think right after, I think Saudi Arabia awarded one of the highest awards to Modi, which was like a slap in the face of Kashmiris who had been looking around and scrounging around for any form of solidarity from the world.
I mean, Saudi Arabia has been on the wrong side more than once. I mean, even if in the latest Palestinian conflict, they have not done anything that is, that could be deemed helpful to the Palestinians who are literally being massacred by thousands. You talked about, extracting resources and ecocide and stuff, and it's. If you really look at that here as well, and you talked about this here, as you learn the indigenous history of this land, you kind of realize that you are living in somebody else's nightmare. And as I learn more of that, because when I first came here, it was more of like, oh, I'm going to that, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And now it's kind of like, well, not really. This is.
It's a very selective way of looking at its history here.
Yeah,
Very selective.
and the part that really gets to me in all of this, and you said this, is how people are just not talking about it. They're comfortable with picking it up and just putting it on the side and just behaving like it never existed. Right. And you look at the Indigenous people's history here or in Canada, or you look at Palestine right now, the current conflict, people don't want to talk about it. Or you talk about Kashmir, people don't want to talk about it. Like, no, let's not talk about that. Like, it's that doesn't exist, right? Like, our definition of freedom and democracy is all of these things. It's Ukraine. It's, when Ukraine is attacked by Russia, then yes, we are all about freedom and democracy. But then the other way around, things kind of change dramatically. It's the selectivism that is baffling for me. And I've tried to explain it to myself in more ways than one, and I have just failed to see what the rationality is behind it.
Well, I think it is if we kind of like keep everything aside and we see this Westphalian Eurocentric order, which has been made preeminent. That it is every other place is not civilized. It's almost like this global manifest destiny that is still in progress. A lot of people would say that Kashmir is not a settler colonialism issue. It's not like Palestine. And we agree that Kashmir and Palestine are not congruent struggles. They have similarities and then there are dissimilarities. But what Kashmiris have seen from their vantage for the last 75 years, a settler colonialism doesn't happen overnight. It kind of like engages, and then you're in the death roll, like the crocodile, like it's in death roll. And that's what's happening and for the last 75 years. And you see those parallels in Palestine, you see those parallels in Kashmir, and those parallels are present in the past of indigenous people here. You only have to go, there's a I mean, I know we can read a lot of history, but curation and exhibition is a completely different other things. And I know they can be biased, but there is an exhibition or was on Sandy Creek Massacre. I'm in Colorado. I'm in Greeley. I work at the University of Northern Colorado. Then there is Denver is very close by. And you kind of see it from the perspective of the natives here, the indigenous people. And it's almost as if the Palestinians are speaking in this moment. And like thinking about the truce that was broken, thinking about stopping of food and water, thinking about waving white flags and still being massacred. It's almost like there's a settler colonial playbook. And I think there is this is the moment where we honestly need a conversation on European and Eurocentric ideologies, especially settler colonialism. And I think the ideal of post-colonialism and sub-alterity and others, it really doesn't work if you do not look at it from the ideal of neocolonialism and thinking about Westphalian democracy and asking a few questions of it, especially that critique it and what it has done. And from Iraq to Afghanistan, to Lebanon and all other places. And I think that's kind
Africa,
of
parts of
to
Africa.
Africa, oh yeah, to Africa, the scramble for Africa and the current scramble for Africa. And that's why I was
Exactly.
kind of thinking about Ghana, I mean, thinking about Kwame Nkrumah's work and this very open and unabashed understanding of neocolonialism, right when you're trying to, straighten a country, get it together. You're talking about neocolonialism and you're talking about your own subjectivity in that. I mean, I find that so important to engage with. And if we don't engage with that kind of work, with that kind of resource, and it's not happening in the 80s, it's not happening in the 2000s, it's happening in the 60s and 50s. And I think that's so important. And that's where there is a difference with how Jawaharlal, in his own writings and in his own governance, is kind of like as if he's coming into his own, as if the civilization of India is becoming congealing and you have taken Pakistan away from it. And then I find that really baffling because I think the narrative of partition, while it's heartbreaking, the kind of displacement and the kind of pogroms it created, but I also think that that narrative was hijacked into this some sort of continuity of this Indian civilization, which was unbroken, completely overlooking the fact that it was a colonial dominion that was brought together, more than 700 plus kingdoms brought together by the colonials. And they did not share the same idiom and ethos and ideology. Yes, they wanted the British paramountcy to be gone, but at the same time, cobbling a country together under a Westphalian ideological system was a more than 20-year-old process that had been started by Indian National Congress that was actually originated from the British itself. So, and I think that's where the difference between how the country formulation of countries as post-colonial democracies and how Africa, right at the get-go, sees its heart, the thing that they're going to be propagating. And that to me is very refreshing. And I feel like that's why the winds of freedom and change probably might come again from Africa as they are in this moment.
I'm into that. I do think that these conversations are important, to your point, because if we don't ask these questions, then we're going to keep repeating the same thing. And in many cases, I know that a lot of people want us to repeat the same thing, but I think it's about time to step out of these and to actually start building the world that can lead to positive outcomes, more positive outcomes. On that note, let me ask you, what is the solution in Kashmir?
I think Kashmir really presents the world with a chance to creatively think about how we want a future. Do we want another behemoth of a country that's going to repeat because the Westphalian prototype is based on a heteropatriarchal system? You know, if people do not agree to that, I'm happy to listen to their viewpoint as well. But I do think it's a system that's based on a hegemonic domination of one over the other. And that's the idea of the democracy that we are propagating. These huge behemoth of nation states with 50, 60, 70, 46, 26 little principalities and states cobbled together. And then you kind of, I don't think that's going to work in a future where we are compromised. Our ecosystem is compromised. Our political systems are compromised. Everything is contaminated. We are not able to sustain these big economies. And we see the failures, the recessions, the bank bailouts, and all of that. We see that in a country as successful as US as per their own norms. But you see the things that are being repeated in India. The poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer. I don't think this system is working. And we do not want this system to be operational anywhere. It's a curse. So if we want to think creatively, I think my issue is the disputes or the settler colonial problems, may that be like Kashmir or Palestine or other problems that Pakistan is also facing or Sri Lanka is facing. I think this is an idealistic solution. It lies in smaller provincial democracies where people exist as peoples, not as commodified citizens. And I think the commodification of citizenry that is happening under the rubric of Westphalian democracies with neoliberal hearts, with capitalistic ethics, I don't think it's working for anyone. It's leading us to dystopia. And that's why we are watching children die day in and day out. And that's why we are being asked to pick sides, see proportion of oppressions, and kind of, it's almost like we have a balance and it's not a balance. It's about justice. It's about just peace. It's time that we offer creative solutions that's going to add to the longevity of the planet rather than take that away. And I think the Anthropocene is telling us that we are creating more harm than the earth is able to repair. And I know this sounds idealistic, but I think we'd be nothing without being idealistic. And in this moment, we cannot be hopeless. That's our only hope. And I feel the solution for Kashmir really lies in some sort of a federation where everyone is autonomous, working together for the good of the Himalayan Federation of Kashmiri States or something. I don't know, call it something, United States of Kashmir. But it has to be, it doesn't have to have the same kind of Westphalian order that cobbles together these huge countries and then wants to create a homogenous people, and everyone is kind of like fighting for the identity, overriding all of that. And it's a hodgepodge, it's a mess, it's a chaos. And I don't think the world can really, they found lithium mines in Kashmir now. And I don't know where that's going to go. Yeah, that's the new news, that we have lithium mines, and that's becoming scarier. And the place is already compromised. You have 8 million people. Then you have 700,000 troops. Then you have many more, like you, tourists are coming in, and then you have resources are being kind of like replaced and rechanged. Laws are being changed. Railways are being brought in. Mountains are being blasted. Orchards are being taken away. Land that used to have agriculture through like crops like rice and everything is changing. On the other hand, now you had the sapphire and marble mines, but now you have the lithium mines, and they are probably outsourcing that. Then you have the hydroelectric projects that have been under India's hegemony, basically, and that Kashmiris used to call that it's the new East India Company. So you have all of that happening, this much, this level of extraction resource. I don't think this area is going to sustain it. And if we do not think creatively about it, I think something drastic is going to happen, which might not be in anyone's control, because the whole area is on a tectonic plate, which is very precarious. So I know that it sounds like a lot of things together, but if you plot them on a map, really, this is a birdcage. If you look at one bar, it doesn't make sense. But if you look at all the bars, this is kind of like from the feminist theory, like that's where Kashmiris are. So these are all the bars. You have to look at them together. You have to look at the resource extraction. You have to look at how the people are dispossessed, and how freedom of expression and all of that, and the military, and they all form these little bars in the bird cage that is around Kashmiris. And I think the world in this moment is really equipped to see this. And unfortunately or fortunately, Palestine has given us a lens to look at it very clearly.
Yeah, Kashmir, they used to say, I remember this in school, it's the crown jewel of India. And that was because of its beauty, right? Because it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. But now to think of it, that there are these resources there, it almost scares me, because now the ecocide that will follow in order to gain access to this is going to be something that is going to be very difficult to survive. As you said, it's a tectonic plate, and there's going to be some problems there. I mean, I hope we can find a solution. I hope that people learn from Palestine. But we'll see what happens in the very near future. Atar, you've been so generous with your time and so much valuable information here. My last question for you today is, can you give us three resources to learn more about Kashmir? You've already given us one, your book, Desolation Called Peace. If you want to add two more or more, feel free.
So I have there's two websites, and they have Kashmir syllabus on them. Yeah, one is standwithkashmir.org, and the other one is Kashmiri Scholars Advocacy and Consultative Network.org, and both of them have links to reports and syllabi, where you can kind of find a lot of information and the books and links to different resources on Kashmir and whatever is being published, and some of it is being updated as well. So I think if the listeners, they look at these two websites, they will find a lot of resources. And then there is another one which I've co-founded, and I am the editor at large for that, but it's hacked every 2 3 months by whoever, I don't know, like some people who really like reading. It's called kashmirlit.org. But the lit is not from literature, it's from lit as in lighted. So that's another one which can kind of give you an idea of what Kashmiris have been talking about. But I do want to mention as we are ending that I'm also talking these days about the disappearance of Kashmiri writing. And that's what they will find on the Kashmir lit website. A lot of Kashmiris are retracting their work, and there are archives that are disappearing. And that's because a lot of people are worried. There was a scholar activist who had written something 10 years back, and he's in jail right now because of the change laws. So I recently co-edited a Duke University special journal for English language notes called Kashmiri Futures with Dr. Misri and Dr. Junaid. And That also is some resource that probably you could attach to the website because it has something hopeful in it. Even though we lost a lot of writers who were writing for it because they did not want to go ahead because of the fear of persecution, but there are some writers in there who just wrote about their experiences and thinking about Kashmiri futures. And there is some conversation between, and you'll find this very interesting. We had a panel at, I think it was NWA conference some years back, and there was a conversation between a scholar from Hawaii, a scholar from here, the indigenous peoples, and then a scholar from Palestine who is also an activist here. And then there was me, and then there were two other indigenous scholars. So there's this conversation that's around sovereignty, that's around dispossession, that's around history, so that your listeners might find useful.
I'm going to look that up. That has to be a brilliant conversation.
It's really interesting. And I've written a p I mean I've contributed to several pieces in there, but I'm really excited about the speculative fiction piece that is there. So
I'm
I'm
going to take a
hoping.
look at that and reach out to you once I finish reading. Thank you so much for your time and thank you for joining me today.
And thank you so much for doing this. I think we need to connect the dots, and I'm just so excited for new broadcasters like you who are taking the time and, just looking for people who have these small voices all over the place and making them big and amplifying them. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to us today. Feel free to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram at Radio Inkalab. Until next time, Abjo.